Vitamin C has evolved. Altrient Vitamin C is a cutting-edge liposomal liquid food supplement designed for maximized absorption. Discover Altrient Liposomal Vitamin C and receive 10% discount by quoting HR10 at abundanceandhealth.com.
Hello and welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, and in the show each week I introduce you to a range of experts from the world of integrative medicine for cancer. The show's named after the charity Yes to Life that I set up more than 15 years ago to support people with cancer in understanding and accessing integrative medicine. Today I'm delighted to be welcoming back someone who is both passionate and extremely knowledgeable when it comes to supporting those with cancer. Sylvia Grizendi is a cancer researcher turned nutritional therapist and never fails to be rewarding to listen to. I'm talking to Sylvia over the internet in East Sussex. Hi Sylvia, brilliant to have you back on the Yes Life Show. It's been quite a while.
Hello Robin, thank you. Yes, it's been a while.
So last week in the show, we did something we'd not really done before, which was we focused really closely on one cancer-related issue. In that case, it was inflammation. Well, it was really interesting, as though inflammation gets mentioned all the time by everybody. It's kind of more in passing, and there's actually so much to learn about it. Well, this week, you and I are going to do something similar. We're going to explore one very prevalent symptom of cancer, cancer-related fatigue. In fact, it's so common it's got its own acronym, CRF, because it's a bit long, and Macmillan report that as many as 9 out of 10 people with cancer get it. Extraordinary. I didn't realise it was that high. So before we get stuck in, as it's some time since you were last guest on the show, I think many listeners would appreciate a bit of an introduction from you in terms of what you do, why you do it, how you came to do it, all that kind of thing.
Okay, thank you, Robin. Yes, a little bit of an introduction. So what can I say? I am a nutritional therapist, and I have been working as a nutritional therapist for the last 7-8 years. But I have a slightly different background. I originally started in cancer research, as you may remember, in specifically cancer biology and genetics. And that was my degree back then in biological sciences. And then I went on and did my PhD in human oncology. That was in Italy. And then did several years as a research fellow in America. Working on cancer molecular pathways. That was a time where we were really digging very deep into molecular pathways of cancer with the intent of finding pharmaceuticals. So that was the very zoom-in approach, digging deep into that. At some point, I decided that wasn't really the thing that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So I left research and went to, stayed in science and went through a series of experiences in scientific publishing and medical communications. But just to make a very long story short, I at some point I started looking for having a more direct involvement in supporting people who live with cancer. That was ultimately what I wanted to do. So I retrained and already during my studies, I knew I wanted to specialize in cancer. So I focused my development in this direction ever since. I started clinical practice straight away, and here I am 7 years later, still very passionate about this field, very sure about this choice, and it requires dedication, I have to say, not only from the point of view of what to do to support these clients who are complex, but also all the studies that you need to put in it.
Right.
In this field of integrative oncology is moving very fast. Yeah. And it's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, I'm just interested to know what your training consisted of.
So my training the normal training as a nutritional therapist I did in CNM in London, and then I followed courses in specifically in cancer nutrition, specifically one from the ION, the Institute of Optimal Nutrition in Richmond, and then I am still doing a course in functional medicine, where obviously I picked as much as possible and still do all the development opportunities in this direction. I am very much inspired by the work of naturopathic oncologists like Liz Altshuler and others that work in a similar way that she does.
Right.
So everything she does, I'm going to study and follow and participate.
She is brilliant, isn't she? She's really brilliant.
She is. I love her, yes.
Yeah.
And this is how I keep up with, obviously, my own study that I do as much as possible. Yes, because predominantly I work with clients with a cancer diagnosis. So at the time of diagnosis or during treatment, after, but also with individuals who want to prevent a diagnosis for different reasons. That's important too. I've chosen not to specialize in one or even a selected type of cancers, because I like to keep the work more open. I know there are other therapies they prefer to specialize. At this moment in time, I don't. I honestly regard cancer as a single disease, which obviously can manifest with different diagnoses. That's very true. But fundamentally, you would always look to identify, to find underlying causes of disease within the cellular microenvironment, right? And these are very individual and different in each person and in diagnosis, so you need to know where to look. But in general, the clinical framework, the therapeutic aims, are conserved, I think, across the different types. And there's so much that can be done also for cancers that are maybe not that much in the mainstream.
Right, yes.
And these people need help too.
They do, they definitely do. Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a very different direction. You're talking about looking at cancer as one thing. I mean, it's quite the opposite direction to where mainstream medicine is going, where it becomes ever more things the further they look. Yes. But it does have this, by pursuing notion of a single disease and finding ways to meet it as a single disease, you actually include a lot of people that, as you're pointing out, they get excluded because there aren't enough of them to warrant the research and the budget to find ways to help them.
Yes, I agree. And like I said, if you look at the underlying mechanisms at play, obviously with all the differences that you need to keep in mind in terms of drivers, mediators, you know, triggers, obviously these are different for each different type of cancer. So the studying is very much on.
Yes.
Yes, the underlying causes are, you know, most of them are conserved, and you would want always to work on the body terrain, that cellular microenvironment, find the imbalances and bring some balance back.
Mm.
Yeah.
So there's a very important message.
Independently of the diagnosis.
Right. So there's an important message there for people who have a rare cancer, that if they're feeling like there's not a lot on offer to them from mainstream medicine, they should be definitely looking out for a good integrative practitioner who may be able to help them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
There are many out there, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so you've told me it's a rather long and a varied journey you've been on to get to where you are today. The common thread running through it all, though, is cancer. Is there a bit of a backstory, a personal story of yours, which has led you to want to work with cancer so particularly?
Well, this is something that makes my story maybe different from others, because I, as far as I remember, really, I wanted to work in this field. I was a
Right.
little girl, really, when I started to wanting to know more. And my feeling is that in some way I've been exposed to this issue early in life, and I just wanted to understand more. And I never had any doubts that there was going to be my direction in studies and after my degree, and so it's just always been almost given for granted that I would study this, and it's
Amazing.
been, you know, a
Right.
constant in my in my yes professional life.
Yeah, it's
Yeah,
like a calling then.
in a way, you can call it that.
Yeah.
It's funny because, like a couple of years ago, I wanted at some point also expand into other areas of health in terms of nutritional therapy, my practice. And in the end, it was really possible. You know, when you follow signals and when you follow your heart, especially, things align in a certain way for you. And if you just let things unfold, you'll go back where you need to be, probably. And so that I just went back to to not wanting to do that too much, and go back to what I was doing. So I really enjoyed it, enjoy it, and yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so on to the topic of the day, CRF. So fatigue's something that's all too common nowadays for a wide variety of reasons. I'm guessing it's still something we're learning a lot about. It's not that long since it was said to be all in the mind and not a physical disorder at all. What I'd like to ask first is, well, how much is known about the commonalities of the various forms of fatigue? And apart from the fact that it's associated with having cancer, are there any other hallmarks of CRF?
Well, that's it, really. You just said it. So, first of all, it's true that the symptom, let's call it the symptom, is not being elucidated in great detail.
Okay.
And for cancer-related fatigue, the big hallmark is being experienced by people with cancer and undergoing cancer treatment. But in terms of the underlying mechanisms, they are very much shared with other types of fatigue. And this is where most of the research has been, to be honest,
Okay.
in terms of really understanding the drivers. Because there are many commonalities, for example, with situations like chronic fatigue syndrome. And if we are going to go into the main mechanisms behind that, you will see that they are shared.
Right.
The unique situation with CRF, if you know, cancer-related fatigue, is that in most cases is just something that the onset can be very rapid. You know, the person can be a person who's never experienced anything like that before,
Right.
and then they start treatment, and the onset can be very rapid. And it can very quickly become difficult to manage, and you know, to push through that kind of fatigue, that level of fatigue. And so, in that sense, this is the starting point, being diagnosed and then undergoing treatment. The good news is that it normally will decline with the end of treatment, as the person recovers. Well, especially if they have taken supporting measures, that really helps.
Okay.
But in some cases, the symptoms can persist for really months and years after treatment completion. This, I would say, is the other maybe a big difference. The persistence of this, because the damage that has been done, if you want to say, call it this way, during the process of the diagnosis and treatment is really difficult to, it's not irreversible, I want to say, but it's difficult to rebalance. There is one thing to say, And this is it. There is the majority of people would at some point recover. But there is a subset, apparently, of individuals who, for different reasons, are more susceptible. Again, I'm linking back to what are the risk factors, contributing factors, etc. This will be around 20 to 40% of the cancer patients. This has been quantified in this way, where the severity and the persistence of the symptom will be much more severe. And many different reasons for that that we can look at, but it's also there is a contribution from pre-existing situations. So, for example, someone who has a history already of poor health, lower nutritional status, issues with mental health and emotional health that predate the diagnosis, they are more vulnerable to developing severe fatigue. And one important factor is their genetic makeup. This seems to be one of the things that this group really has specific genetic variants. I'm not talking about disease-related mutations here. It's just the
No,
variants,
right.
the polymorphisms that may influence not only the response to treatment, but also the risk then to developing a more or less severe type of fatigue as a result.
Okay. That sounds eerily reminiscent of a certain pandemic we're very familiar with in the way that different people respond.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't think about that, but yes.
Yeah.
Response to the diagnosis, response to treatment, and then what are the risk factors for that person may predate, yes, that particular situation.
Yeah. I find it fascinating that finally the puzzle of why people respond so differently to the same circumstance is beginning to be understood, isn't it? That this genetic information is actually uncovering why. Some people can live very badly by all accounts, smoking and drinking and everything, and have very long lives, and other people just can't get away with that kind of thing. And so much of it seems to be kind of in our genetic makeup.
Yes, and in particular in I think you're referring to the field of nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics and how much we are learning from these kind of studies. In this particular regard of fatigue, you would actually has been studied. You would look at genes that express for pro-inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-6 is a very important one. Tumor necrosis factor is the other one. So whether the person has a higher risk of higher expression levels of these cytokines can play a role. And yes, there has been studies where the frequency of these polymorphisms have been correlated with the risk of developing severe fatigue. Obviously, these are all correlations and associations. These are observational studies. There's no causative correlation being made, but still an important source of information to have.
So, for somebody going to, they know they're going to have a course of chemotherapy, for example, is there any merit in actually having a test to find out whether they should prepare themselves in some way for the fact they're likely to suffer from fatigue?
Yes, I think there is. Like I said, there is a contribution of your status of health and fitness at that particular point, so before you start treatment, as a contributing factor to developing more or less severe fatigue. So we haven't talked about what are the major contributing factors, or underlying mechanism. But I would say maybe it's difficult to talk about testing before having discussed that. But in terms of let's say contributing factors, there are things that you can rule out, first of all, to be prepared, like you said. For example, checking out for anemia or a risk of developing anemia is just a very important thing to do. Because even very simple nutritional deficiencies like vitamin D, vitamin B12, iron, zinc can make you more susceptible to developing anemia and therefore having experiencing higher levels of fatigue. So nutritional deficiency is the other thing that you want to look at, and other types of imbalances, for example, your blood markers, definitely for inflammation, your metabolic health, going back again to what you mentioned about a certain pandemic, but yes, your ability to manage blood sugar, all of the metabolic aspects of your health. I would definitely look at organic acids in terms of understanding functioning of energy pathways, mitochondrial health. We haven't mentioned that, but mitochondrial dysfunction is one of the underlying mechanisms that have been recognized, not just in CRF, but also in chronic fatigue syndrome. This is very well established. I would also look at levels and metabolism of hormones like not just insulin but steroid hormones like cortisol and melatonin is also important for reasons that we can discuss, and that DNA test to look at the genetic variants that may have a role to play here.
So there's plenty you can look out for and maybe account for before you get to the treatment. So I think we've identified basically there are two completely different reasons why somebody going through cancer treatment could get CRF. One of them's the cancer itself, and the other one's the treatments they're going to have. So am I right there?
Yes, absolutely. These are the two major things. Because, for example, just to go into a little bit more detail, one of the mechanisms that is probably underlying everything else is inflammation at this point. There is a very well-established association between inflammation and fatigue in cancer. And where is inflammation coming from in this context? It can come from the tumor itself, first of all, and by the immune, the recruitment, let's say, of immune cells at the tumor microenvironment. So yes, the tumor itself can contribute to increased inflammation. Then the treatment, we know radiation and chemotherapy both can induce inflammation, and with that behavioral changes that influence, so by that I mean influence the response of the person to fatigue and the sometimes the triggering of what's known as the vicious cycle of fatigue. So it starts, like I said, fatigue can start with a very rapid onset at the beginning of treatment, and the person experiencing this fatigue may react by adopting a more sedentary type of lifestyle. They are finding very difficult to keep up with movement and normal activities, and that will have an impact in turn on their, for example, the conditioning of their body and muscle mass, which in turn can trigger a situation where the person is less able to do normal activities that will help them to look after themselves, their health, like nutrition and exercise, which is a big one for counteracting fatigue. And then again, this produces more fatigue. So you can see there is a cycle there that can start at the beginning of treatment sometimes, and it's difficult to shift after that.
Right. A downward spiral.
Yes, inflammation from psychological stress is really another one. And the polymorphisms. So how does that work in this? Going back to your question about other types of fatigue, The state of inflammation can have different consequences, but in terms of this topic, this issue, an elevation of these pro-inflammatory cytokines that I just mentioned may send certain signal to the central nervous system. This is one of the major mechanisms, and then induce certain behavioral changes that are there essentially to as a mechanism of protection, really, to promote really survival of the individual, and sometimes can trigger an exaggerated production of stress hormones, in particular cortisol, but also behaviors like lethargy and sleepiness are part of this picture. Mm. And we know the inflammation is so important in this because there has been studies where they have essentially targeted inflammation with anti-cytokine agents, and this has directly affected fatigue in a beneficial way. So in a way, you know that by stopping, this has been done with pharmaceuticals, that's why we have a clear picture here, stopping these high levels of inflammation benefits these patients. But then inflammation interacts with many other systems. It's not just, you know, this one mechanism.
Mm. Amazing. So these very different apparent reasons for getting CRF, the treatment and the cancer, the thing they share in common is the inflammation then. And very interesting. It happens to follow on from last week's investigation into the topic of inflammation.
Yes.
So anybody didn't hear last week's show, get on and have a listen. So, very interesting. Okay. Just one thing I'm kind of want to ask out of interest is there a relationship between CRF and cachexia or wasting?
Yes, there is definitely a sort of an interaction there in terms of functional interaction, because you can see this from what I mentioned in terms of the vicious cycle of CRF, where the fatigue has a direct effect on the ability of the person to move as they were able to do before, and a direct effect on muscle mass and this sort of peripheral aspects of fatigue, neuromuscular junctions as well, so how the brain regulates muscle function. There is an element of depression setting in as well. Mm. The changes in the neuroendocrine profile, so this is like a fancy word to say how the brain controls the expression of stress hormones like cortisol, is also important. There is an element of anorexia that can be associated with CRF, so less appetite, less intake of foods that are important, macronutrients like protein. There is an element of, insomnia is another big one, but yes, in very severe cases of CRF, there is a higher risk of going in the direction of then metabolic, catabolic, let's say, activity and cachexia, although that is really like a very advanced state.
Yes.
And there is so much that can be done to prevent the person going in that direction.
Mm, interesting how these things are all beginning to link together, though, isn't it? And you see how they're connected. This is going to have to be the short version, but you've alluded already to the role of the mitochondria in chronic fatigue. Do you want to just say a little bit more about that? But it will have to be a little bit because we're going to run out of time.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. We know, first of all, just to be very, very brief, that cancer itself has roots in the dysfunction of mitochondria, and this is point one. So then the treatment is really when things can become even more critical, because a number of chemotherapeutics and radiation are mitochondrial toxins. So mitochondria can get damaged with treatment. And why this is a problem? Because clearly this is the organelle in the cell where energy is produced. So a damage to the mitochondria means a disruption in the cellular energy supply and the production of ATP, which is the energy currency that every single cell in the body needs to use in order to function. So you can see how this is related to energy. Right. It's where the energy is produced. In addition to that, so we don't know the exact mechanisms yet,
okay.
But we know that when mitochondria are damaged, in addition to being less able to produce energy, there is an increase in oxidative stress, which feeds into inflammation, which leads into increased production of lactate. That's the other thing. So more acidity in the body. And all of these aspects are connected with physiological fatigue and alteration, as we said already, in the metabolism of skeletal muscle. So yeah, mitochondria are at the center of many different type of fatigue, and this one as well, aggravated by the fact that cancer is already mitochondrial disease plus treatment. So it would be one of the starting points in terms of supporting the individual from the nutritional point of view, but also, I mean, exercise is absolutely great for mitochondrial recovery.
Good. Well, look, you've gone straight into my next question, which is to talk about the important matter of what to do about it. So I'm just interested in what the basic tools you use are to help combat CRF.
Yes. So first of all, I would like to say that what has been seen is that because fatigue has a multidimensional nature. So we are talking about physical symptoms and mental, emotional. There is a whole number of different aspects that are affected for the individual. It has been seen that interventions that influence these multiple systems at the same time are more effective, definitely, than targeting just one thing. So just to be a give you a practical example, exercising will have a more beneficial effect compared to using a pharmaceutical to target one aspect,
right,
for example. But just to zoom in to what can really help, first of all, any therapist that want to help with this will need to understand the person very well and their circumstances as the first step. So these, before they do any, they make any recommendations. And they need to understand exactly what may be more probably the contributing factors that predate the diagnosis, during and treatment, etc. And also what is already helping. Sometimes people find ways, and those are all clues that you can use,
right,
to understand the more probable underlying mechanisms. How the situation is impacted, what they can do, what they are unable to do, rule out, those anemia, nutritional deficiencies that we talked about,
yes,
before, and doing those tests, and understanding, also having a sense of their emotional and mental state. So in terms of what you are aiming at, definitely reducing inflammation. You would do that,
right,
directly using nutrition, using nutraceuticals and botanicals, and indirectly and looking after the gut, for example, is a very good way. And there has been studies showing that, for example, a gut health, when it's in a better state, will help people to lower the risk of developing fatigue. So reducing inflammation, rebalancing that neuroendocrine situation whereby people This is very important one, because when expression of hormones like cortisol go out of balance, you will see people lose that nice curve of high cortisol in the morning, declining cortisol during the day, and then having low cortisol in the evening. It is what helps the person to go into sleep.
Right.
But with people with fatigue, we see these flattened cortisol curve where they have high levels that don't change throughout the day. So this is impact their sleep,
right,
their biological clock, everything. So reshaping that cortisol curve, it's very important, supporting the nervous system, and in all possible ways. So rebalancing sympathetic and parasympathetic mind-body techniques are really, really crucial here. And supporting their sleep, like I said, this is very affected. But obviously, if you start from there, if it is, this is an aspect that is really difficult for them, you see how just by fixing that aspect, the person will feel better the next day, and so on and so on. Mm. So it's a matter of breaking that cycle in the way that it's more suitable for that person, with gentle adjustments and creating you know, a gradual change, naturally also healing the mitochondria, etc. Mm. So from the point of view of a nutritional therapist, you will start with diet, certainly. So you know, there has been people who have looked at all different types of diets for this. There's, you know, paleo, keto, vegan, etc. Still, the evidence seems to point in the direction of a good anti-inflammatory diet with lots of colorful veggies, Mediterranean style, with whole foods, avoiding processed, obviously, because of the toxicity of that. Keeping the carbohydrates under control, this is important for many different reasons. The healthy fats, and I'm talking about the omega-3s here, are essential to curb that inflammation. And high-quality protein, wherever it's come from, it doesn't really matter. It needs to be high quality to prevent muscle loss. And this is naturally easy to understand why you would go for an anti-inflammatory diet, is because the richness of the phytochemicals to block the oxidative stress. And as you know, these are chemicals that talk to our genes. And NF-kappa-B, which is the master switch of inflammation, will respond. So, yeah.
Right.
You will start from this. But obviously, this is very general.
Yes.
And
yes,
you will need to adapt to the person. Fiber is incredibly important, and I don't want to go into much detail, but there are studies showing that more fiber during the day, less risk of fatigue. And all the mitochondrial supporting nutrients, B vitamins, CoQ10, zinc, vitamin C, these are all important. You can do it with food, or if needed, you consult with a professional to supplement this. It's really important that people do this, because especially if they are taking medications.
Yeah.
So this needs to be a bespoke approach. Looking after the adrenals, so that cortisol axis that I was talking about, vitamin C and magnesium, but also your botanicals, anti-inflammatory botanicals, the turmeric and ginger is really a big one here, if people can tolerate it. And what else? Medicinal mushrooms, reishi in particular, it's so strongly anti-inflammatory.
Right.
And maybe if I had to choose one nutrient, really, amongst others, two things, maybe more,
right,
if I can.
Yeah.
One is L-carnitine, really. Carnitine is often already deficient in cancer patients for other reasons. But then when the mitochondria are impacted, this is where it's even more needed. And at the same time, it supports appetite, it supports muscle mass. If it is the acetylated form, it can go through the blood-brain barrier and, you know, is a precursor of acetylcholine, so improves mental function, mood. And it's very good for physical fatigue, for muscle tone, for reducing muscle weakness, and breaking up that vicious cycle that I was referring to.
Right.
And naturally, carnitine is responsible for bringing those fatty acids or the omega-3s, etc., through the mitochondrial membrane and as a source of energy. So again, energy production. And the other one is adaptogens. Really, these are my favorites in absolute. So your adaptogenic herbs, ashwagandha, ginseng. Ginseng is the most studied in the context of fatigue. Rhodiola. These are generally well tolerated in cancer patients. They can target cytokines directly. They reset. I would say the most important thing, they may reset the sensitivity to the to high level of cortisol. So cortisol have a negative feedback. When it's too much, it shuts down the pathway that produces it. But this seems to be lost in fatigue. But when adaptogenic herbs are in the picture, this sensitivity can be regained. And same for the autonomic nervous system. So helping that parasympathetic nervous system that looks after healing and repairing and detoxifying digestion, immune system, these herbs will help with that. And modulate also the perception of stress in a beneficial way. So the outlook, the mindset, really helpful in that department as well.
Amazing. So, if I could sort of do a little summary of what you just said, it seems to me that there are some good answers. There are good tools to help people with CRF, but it's not a case of simple answers. It's actually sounds an amazingly complex territory and very many things to take into account, both in the nature of the fatigue and the nature of the person who has it. And therefore, consulting someone who knows what they're talking about, like you do, could be pretty important to getting a good result.
Yes, I think having some help alongside when the situation is already very stressful, it can be important. It can be, make a difference. Yes, it can make a difference, I believe, yes.
And out of interest, overall, how successful do you think you are in being able to combat fatigue for people? And how long does it take to achieve a significant improvement?
Ah, what a question, Robin. It's a difficult one because it's so individual. After many years, I can really say that each person is so different, not just in the way they respond to your recommendation, your suggestions, but really in how they are ready to embark in change. So making those little changes. That so the success and the length of time that it's needed to recover, in the end, it really depends on the person what they can put into it. We are here to give all the information and all everything that person needs to know and what they need to access. In the end, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know if this is how to define that, but it comes down to the determination. And I have such admiration for people who put a lot of work in getting better.
Me too.
So if they receive the correct information, it's possible. Definitely, I can say that I've seen situation turning around in a relatively a short period of time. It takes time because when you are looking at complex systems like cortisol that is stuck on a high level and doesn't come down, or melatonin completely disappearing, as you know, is the hormone of sleep. So this takes time. But yes. There is also hope and possibility.
Great, great. Okay, well, look, would you like to tell people how they can find out more about you, about your work, and how they contact you?
What can I say? I have a website
Yeah.
that people can visit. Is my name is silviagresendi.com. It's just a very simple website. I don't put a lot of information there. Anyone is welcome to contact me and to have a chat. I always make a point of starting any therapeutic relationship with getting to know each other and seeing if we are a good fit.
Okay.
I predominantly work through referrals, so I don't market my services too much because this is what happens, really. My clients are referring new clients, and this is how things have been working for quite some time.
Right.
Can I just add one more
sure.
thing, which I think is really important? I think people know this, but as much as I believe in the power of nutrition, I believe really that exercise is one of the most powerful things to do in this situation. And I know it's very difficult to say to someone who is already very fatigued that they need to do more, to move more.
Yeah.
An awareness, I would say, of the importance of exercise, body movement in general, and fatigue should be emphasized. Because, like we said, there is a chance that fatigue will set in very early in treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to start this at the beginning of treatment.
Okay.
So prevent the setting in of that very difficult fatigue before it does. And, right. and with exercise, this is possible. You may be aware of clinics in the States that ask people to be on a treadmill when they are receiving
yes.
treatment.
Yes.
And this is quite telling. In the way exercise can make a really difference in prevention.
Well, thank you for putting that in.
Happening.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. As expected, there was an awful lot to talk about on the subject of CRF, and clearly there's an
yes.
awful lot to know about it. Thanks so much for joining me today for this exploration and sharing your accumulated understandings on the subject of CRF.
Thank you, Robin, for having me. My pleasure.
So I'll spell Sylvia's name to help you find her website, sylviagrisendi.com. So it's SilviaGrisendi, sylviagrisendi.com. So I hope you found that interview as interesting as I did. You might just catch the last of the early bird tickets for Yesterlife Spring Congress that's on the 27th and 28th of March. It's online and focuses entirely on nutritional science and cancer. The lineup of experts is exceptional. We have Sheila Dillon, presenter of the BBC Food Programme, Dr. Naisha Winters, Dr. Penny Kekayoglu, Dr. David Unwin, Dr. Rob Verkirk, Nikki Robinson and Dr. Catherine Zollman from Penny Bron. We've got a lineup of functional medicine practitioners as Joe Gamble, Victoria Fenton, Mark Bennett, Dawn Muldrum, as well as workshops led by Britt Cordy and Dr. Saskia Kloppenberg-Veith. It's going to be a weekend brimming with inspiration and education. To see the full programme and to book your place, go to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the button in the banner at the top of the homepage. This will take you to the dedicated event website, which tells all. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'll be back next week with another expert guest from the world of integrative medicine for cancer at the same time here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.